Today we're having Scott with us and to talk about what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in Ukraine. And so nice to have you back, Scott.
Thank you.
And let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. How fragile is the situation right now between Hezbollah and Israel? And Iranians are talking about, it seems that they want to bomb Israel. Is that serious?
Well, we'll find out. I'm loath to put myself in the shoes of Iranian decision makers and such. How fragile is the situation? There is no situation between fragility implies something delicate, something that maybe you want to preserve. There is no situation between Israel and Hezbollah that's fragile because it's conflict. So I think we have to be, more precise. I think we've reached the existential phase of this conflict. Israel crossed a red line in murdering Hassan Nasrallah. There's a phrase from, I think it's Matthew 26:52, he who takes up the sword shall perish by the sword. Israel has taken up the sword. Now, I know there's going to be people out there saying, Israel didn't start October 7th. Yeah, they did. They started it back in 1948, and they've been pushing Palestine towards that ever since. Israel continues to occupy part of southern Lebanon, the Sheba Farms, which gives Hezbollah the legitimacy for its continued existence. And Israel has behaved as an out-of-control rogue state for much of its history. One can safely say that with the death of Yitzhak Rabin back in 1995, I believe, that Israel's never been serious about peacefully coexisting with its Palestinian neighbors. So it is what it is. We're entering a phase. I think those people who, are shouting out how Israel has won this war have no clue what war is and no understanding of what happened here. If you think you're going to, if you're a football coach in the NFL and you think you're going to get to the Super Bowl by using trick plays alone, you'll be sorely disappointed. Trick plays may win one game late in the game, but trick plays do not a winning season make. And what Israel has pulled off in the last couple days, it's a series of trick plays. It looks good. Makes the ESPN highlight reels, pagers going off. Wow, headlines. Who the hell's talking about pagers today? Did it change anything? No. Motorola handheld walkie-talkies going off. Wow. Who's talking about that today? No one. Nasrallah's dead. Wow. You really think that changed anything? You don't think Hezbollah has been preparing for Nasrallah's death ever since Israel was trying to kill him? Israel's been killing the Hezbollah leadership for some time now. Nasrallah took over in 1992 because Israel assassinated the head of Hezbollah. Nasrallah has prepared for this moment. The leadership is prepared. They have lines of succession. This is an organization that has been preparing for the very fight that Israel is now bringing to them since 2006, 18 years. You don't think they've thought through every contingency? Yeah, like I said, a trick play. Oh, pagers going off. Who would have thought about that? No one. So Israel got a cheap headline-grabbing moment, inflicted some casualties. But again, for every Hezbollah person you take out, the resistance organizational structure has somebody already identified to take their place. It's a cellular structure designed to, break apart as necessary. For instance, the Southern Lebanese Front will fight independent of direction from the Hezbollah center under the assumption that Israel would disrupt communications. So it's not as though there's a bunch of fighters right now saying, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? They know what to do. They've trained for it. They're prepared for it. And they'll execute this operation. Does this mean that everything's hunky-dory for Hezbollah? No, it doesn't. They're being put under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. But as I said, it's something that Hezbollah has prepared for 18 years. Has Israel prepared for this? You see, I think Hez was one of those fighters that prepares to go into the ring by actually sparring, meaning not just taking a swing at a heavy bag, but getting hit. You know, understand what it means to get hit, being prepared to get hit, conditioned to be hit. Israel's not prepared to be hit. Israel is, you know, one of these people who goes in, hits the heavy bag, hits the speed bag, poses in front of mirrors, flexes. But now it's time to get in the ring. We'll find out what they got. As for Iran, let's see. A lot of talk today about Iran hitting Israel with missiles. That's a big step. I don't think Iran will take such a step unless they've thought through the consequences. The prime minister of Russia just flew to Tehran, where there are high-level consultations. Iran is a member of BRICS. There's a big BRICS summit coming up at the end of this month that's going to radically transform the world we live in terms of, geopolitics. Iran thinks strategically. So if Iran makes a decision to strike Israel, Iran has charted out, the risks and the benefits. And we'll see what happens. I don't know what Israel expected by taking out Hassan Nasrallah, that this would just lead to automatic victory, the collapse of Hezbollah, the collapse of Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu thinks so, and with his perfect American accent, he addressed the people of Iran. But and I know he wasn't speaking to anybody inside Iran. He was speaking to Los Angeles. That's why he had that nice American accent going. You see, when Netanyahu wants to be an Israeli, he has that thick Israeli accent, as if he's from the kibbutz, not from Poland. But now he put on the whole American thing because he's speaking to the expatriate audience in Los Angeles, the monarchists, the people who fled after the fall of Reza Shah Pahlavi, the people who have been opposing the theocracy ever since then, the people who have been involved in opposition, violent opposition to Iran. Now, go back to 2023, take a look at some of the videos that came out. They're flying the monarchist flag, burning down police stations. They were crushed, as all opposition movements eventually are inside Iran, because whether you like it or not, the theocracy has majority support. And that's just the way it is. Netanyahu is somehow laboring under the pretense that by murdering Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will collapse, and with it will Iran will as well. I think he's about to find out how resilient the Iranian-led resistance really is. I would have this word of caution for anybody who thinks about taking on Hezbollah and the Iranians. Martyrdom is a thing. And when you're dealing with people who sincerely believe the religion, the tenets of their faith, and that faith embraces martyrdom as a legitimate outcome, in some cases during jihad, a desirable outcome, killing them ain't going to solve anything. When you cut off the head of the Hydra, three more spring up. And by taking out Nasrallah, all you did is guarantee that somebody stepped in. And that somebody right now is his cousin. He's now the I can't pronounce his last name, but
Saif ad-Din.
Okay. He he was the head of, it's not as though they pulled him out of nowhere. This is a man who's been literally operating in Hassan Nasrallah's shadows. He's headed up the executive committee of Hezbollah, which means he knows the leadership. He's been on every important decision made, so he knows everything Hassan Nasrallah knows. In fact, I would say that he's actually better prepared to lead Hezbollah right now in this crisis because, as anybody knows, the CEO isn't necessarily the person you go to learn about day-to-day operations of an organization. They have lieutenants. They have deputies to do that. The CEO sits back and issues statements and signs documents and provides guidance. And Nasrallah was the CEO. But the people running the show are different people. And this cousin was one of the people running the show. It's the same thing. They kill the heads of various departments. And it's a serious blow. These guys have corporate knowledge. But to pretend that, the pyramid, the leadership pyramid of Hezbollah is so narrow that when you take out the top, the pyramid collapses is absurd. It's a very broad pyramid. And below each person, there are a dozen or more ready to take their place, and below them are more. This is a true resistance organization, a true guerrilla-style cellular structure, and the idea that you're going to pop a couple bubbles and the whole thing is going to collapse is ludicrous. Is Hezbollah in for a long, difficult period? Absolutely. So is Lebanon. But so too is Israel. And the question now is who can last longer? Lebanon and Hezbollah are conditioned for this fight. They've been in the ring. They've been sparring. They've been punched. Israel, I think, is straight off the couch. A little bit of heavy bag work, a little bit of speed bag work. And now they're told they're getting in the ring with Mike Tyson. Good luck with that.
The president of Iran, Pezeshkian, was talking about after assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. The United States tried to talk with them in order not to attack Israel and giving them some hopes that they're going to make a deal for the benefit of Gazans. Pezeshkian was talking about this. And it doesn't seem that the United States kept that promise. And right now, as Iran just talking about bombing Israel, they're trying to connect, they're trying to talk with Iranian again. On the other hand, Netanyahu is trying desperately to get connected with Putin and to talk with Putin. How do you put these two directions together?
Well, first of all, I understand the United States has lost all credibility. Any credibility it had is gone. I know that the new Iranian president ran on a platform of not wanting to turn away from the West, willing to reach out. And he made some movements in that direction, went to New York, et cetera. And I think it's also clear that Iran and the United States have been engaged for some time now, even going back to Raisi, in back channel negotiations, behind the scenes to prevent what's happening right now, this kind of confrontation. And the United States, all it can bring to bear is promises, that they promise that if Iran does this, if Iran doesn't do that, then the United States will do something. Iran has lived up to every single one of its obligations. When Iran makes a deal, Iran sticks to that deal by the letter. Look at the JCPOA. Iran hasn't violated the JCPOA. Everything Iran does is permitted under the JCPOA. I think it would be interesting to go back and do the public release of the what would be sort of the negotiating talking points, negotiating briefing within the United States about the specific language used in the JCPOA, especially the language that we thought would be used for snapback sanctions that we insisted on putting in there, so that if any party fails to deliver, then the other party can, walk away from its obligations and go back to existing things. And we put it in there because we were under the assumption that Iran would violate the JCPOA, that, but in then doing so, we would snap back in sanctions. Well, I'd love to read the Iranian one too, where they're sitting there going, they really want to do this? Because Iran knew it wasn't going to be them that broke it. It should be the United States that broke it. I don't think they expected it to break so soon. Iran always knew that the United States would never live up to the obligations that were inherent in the so-called sunset clauses. Why did they know that? Because Barack Obama said so even before the JCPOA was signed. He said, because someone said, well, what happens when we come to the sunset clauses and you have to start lifting restrictions on Iran's nuclear enrichment program? And Barack said, well, at that time, we will reassess and see where we go. Meaning that if the United States didn't get what it wanted from the deal, and what it wanted from the deal were things that weren't part of the deal, they wanted Iran to walk away from nuclear enrichment. The deal allowed them to move to enrichment. We thought we could coerce them away. If we weren't going to get what we wanted outside of the framework, then we would dissolve the framework and start all over. That was Barack Obama that said this. And so the Iranians are going, all right, we like this language. And when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, Iran said, okay, you're out. Europe's not complying. Therefore, we no longer need to comply because we're relying on, I think it's paragraph 24 and there maybe paragraph 36. I could be wrong on those two paragraphs, but the two paragraphs that allow for this to happen. Iran has complied fully with all of its legal obligations. It's 100% in total compliance with the JCPOA because the JCPOA no longer has standing because the members, the European members in the United States withdrew. Guess what happens when you withdraw from an agreement? Your opinion no longer counts. And so Europe said, well, you know, we'd like America to come back, but meanwhile, we're not going to engage fully in the economic activities that we are obligated to do so under the agreement. So Iran went, well, you're not complying. We're not comply. Boom, that's it. And yet now this new president is saying he's willing to sit down and negotiate with the United States about how to, you know, get the JCPOA back to being relevant. I mean, I wouldn't advise him to do that, but I guess, you know, that, and it's a strange move given Iran's pivoting to BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, this big strategic pivot east. So what it implies, and this is, you know, where what people have to pay attention to, is it implies that there's a domestic political imperative within Iran that says we're not ready to make that big pivot just yet, that there's still an element within the Iranian leadership. Because remember, all during Rafsanjani, all during Khatami, they were trying to make good with the West. They didn't want to make the pivot east. There were a lot of people saying, let's pivot to China, let's pivot to Russia, let's pivot to Eurasia. And the big players, the big economic powerhouses, and Rafsanjani is still a huge, I'm not going to accuse him of corruption, but you know, the man is very rich. And he became very wealthy at a time when Iran was going through the post-war reconstruction boom, and suddenly Rafsanjani's family owns all the companies that are making money, and he became a very rich man owning all the good real estate, and he's still very powerful today. And there are others out there that made a lot of money. And I think they're looking at their investments and saying, you know, one, our investments are going to start to go down here, lose value, because they were all heavily contingent upon maintaining good relations with the West. And there's a whole cast of characters now that are going to challenge us politically because they're going to become very wealthy by pivoting to the East. And so what I think what you're seeing within Iran is this rearguard action by wealthy established elites that are saying, let's give the West one more chance, one more chance, one more chance. And that was enough. And again, we just have to remember these things. You know, there's a vetting process that takes place before you get your name as a presidential candidate. You know, the Guardian Council has to approve you. And the Guardian Council doesn't operate in a vacuum, meaning that there's somebody up there in the Supreme Leader's inner circle whispering down, going, you can give this guy the green light. You can give this guy the green light. And I think there was sentiment from above that said, we haven't won over the pro-West contingent yet. They're not ready to make the leap. So we need a leader that's willing to at least go through the motions of making that happen. So they got their leader. And this is the stupidity of the United States and Israel. Again, the stupidity of them. Because instead of exploiting this and engaging, the United States, we know, doesn't engage in good faith on anything. We know the United States is incapable of being honest. But if you're an American, I would have sat there and said, okay, we know what we want to achieve. But right now we got the Iranians somewhat in a quandary. They want to engage. Let's engage. Let's drag this thing out. Let's drag this thing out. Let's see what we can get out of this. And I would tell the Israelis the same thing. I would have told the Israelis, look, if we drag this thing out, we end up effectively neutralizing Iran because we're going to keep them in a state of limbo. They're not going to decisively engage this way or that way. That'll buy us time for you to close the deal with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia didn't jump ship to BRICS straight away. Saudi Arabia withheld jumping. They still are considering it, but they haven't made that jump yet, which means Saudi Arabia also has a large group of people inside are saying, we don't want a divorce from the West yet. So we can buy time, muddy the waters, and you, Israel, and Saudi Arabia can close that deal you're looking for. If not outright diplomatic recognition, at least a reconciliation, a normalization of relations that would put in motion the pieces that need to happen for the India Middle East Economic Corridor, all the things that Israel claims they want. That's the direction they should have gone. They were winning. You know, even after, you know, Hamas took a big gamble by attacking on October 7th. They shot their bolt. That was it. Now they've got no more offensive power. They got a couple rockets, but Iron Dome can take care of that, and some selective bombing can take care of that. And nobody will condemn Israel for bombing Gaza after they've been rocketed. No one will condemn them. It just, you can't. But instead, Israel overreacts, plays in. If Israel had just simply went, wow, that was stupid of you to do, Hamas. We're shutting down all the work applications you had, all those people that were getting income in Israel. We'll never get income again. We're shutting down everything. You're not allowed to come over. The world's not going to go against you for that. How could they? I mean, there'll be the activists that are screaming bloody murder, but they have no standing. Hamas came across the border, attacked Israel, and you know, a bunch of people died as a result. And then Israel just basically lays siege to Gaza. And again, they fire rockets and you bomb, but you don't level entire neighborhoods. You don't kill people. It's just a very selective problem. But you lay siege to Gaza and you get the world community to rally around you. And by doing this, you preserve your diplomatic interaction with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states, who hate Palestine to begin with and despise Hamas to begin with. And you isolate Hamas, and Hamas withers on the vine because it's got nothing. It did everything to get you to suck into this trap. Don't take the bait. If they'd done that, there would be normalized relations with Saudi Arabia right now. Palestine would be a defeated entity. Hamas would be done with. There wouldn't be a war on the northern front. Hezbollah's not going to get engaged for that. If Hamas attacks and Israel doesn't overreact, Hezbollah's not going to do anything. They're not going to throw it away. Lebanon wouldn't let them. Politics is a strange thing. So what we have a situation here right now is that we have pushed Iran to where we have lost, I believe, the opportunity to meaningfully engage. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of phone calls going on right now. I know that Netanyahu's trying to call Putin. Why? Well, Putin just dispatched his prime minister to Iran, where things were discussed. Shoigu was just in Iran, where things were discussed. The Russians are literally... you know, they have their finger on the pulse about what Iran's going to do. And again, Russia is heavily vested in Iran's inclusion in the BRICS summit. So there's some desperation here. But again, I just want to ask, why is Netanyahu in a panic trying to reach Putin? I mean, he killed Hassan Nasrallah. What did he think was going to happen? He positioned his forces going into Lebanon. What did he think was going to happen? He continues to bomb Lebanon. Now he bombed the Iranian embassy in Tehran, in Damascus, is the rumor. What did he think was going to happen? Why is he so panicked right now? I think he's panicked because he understands the consequences, that Israel isn't nearly as strong as the posturing has made it out to be. The Israeli military cannot go into southern Lebanon in a meaningful fashion. That globally, Israel has no support. There's literally no support for what Israel is doing right now. Israel is the bad guy. They're in the wrong. They didn't get, other than the United States, you don't have everybody jumping up and down saying, good job for killing Nasrallah. Everybody recognized how utterly destabilizing that was. Again, it's hard to predict outcomes because, you know, we're talking about decisions that are going to be existential in nature if they're taken one way or the other, which means it's a life and death struggle. I don't know if Iran is ready for a life and death struggle over Lebanon at this point in time. Lebanon, Hezbollah has not been defeated. That's what people need to understand. Hezbollah has not been defeated. I mean, they took a couple hits, but they have not been defeated. And I don't think Iran is viewing Hezbollah as a defeated entity right now. But we go back to April. You know, they established, you know, a level of deterrence superiority based upon the notion that if Israel were to you know, carry out attacks against Iran, that Iran would respond. And if Israel bombed the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that's an attack against Iran, and Iran has no choice but to respond. So I think they will. The question is the scope and scale and the duration. Are we going to get a repeat of April? Are we going to get something a little bit more severe? Are they going all in? I think Iran's going to hit, and then I think Russia and China are going to be reaching out, and the United States will reach out, and there's going to be an effort at brokering some sort of you know, diplomatic pause here. But Israel may have gone too far. This we'll see. It's a dangerous situation.
And in the inauguration of the new president of Iran, we had the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. And when they were in New York talking with Washington and the Zarif team, we know how they're capable, how they're connected with the people in Washington. They wanted to talk with them. And we had the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. And right now they're trying to invade, to go with this offensive in Lebanon. Can we conclude that all of these attempts on the part of the Netanyahu administration is to bring in Iran and the United States to make a fight between these two countries?
No, I think we're looking at the wrong thing. I mean, that's a strategic objective that's been the strategic objective of the Netanyahu government for some time now. But Netanyahu is a realist. He knows that Biden in an election year isn't going to war with Iran. It just isn't going to happen unless Iran massively attacks the United States. That would be the end of the Kamala Harris candidacy. It just because the consequences already we saw just over the threat of missiles hitting Israel, we saw the price of oil jack up $3 a barrel instantly. Damn, why didn't I show you? Why didn't I buy oil? And if it's an all-out war, you're going to see the price of oil go through the roof. And when that happens, for Biden, this is, let's just put this way. There's a longshoreman strike taking place right now in the United States, shutting down all the ports. If this strike continues, in 2 weeks, this country is going to be in economic chaos. Heading into the Christmas holidays. I mean, it's literally the kiss of death. For go back to James Carville, 1992, the message he put on the door to the Clinton War Room. It's the economy, stupid. That's all you need to be focused on right now. The economy, the economy, the economy. The last thing the Biden administration wants to be doing is getting engaged in a war it can't win against Iran. The consequences of a regional conflict that had disrupted global energy supplies is catastrophic for both the European economy that's already on the verge of collapse. You start jacking up energy prices, and that's the end of Europe rolling into a wintertime. This is why Olaf Scholz is trying frantically talking about getting a phone call with Putin, because he realizes the game's up, man. It's over. You want to watch the political revolution that's taking place in Europe finish the job. These far-right parties, conservative parties, that are, against what the, leftists and the Greens have done to Europe in the aftermath of the special military operation. Jack up the price of oil. Make life impossible to live. Make businesses impossible to function in Europe. And that's the end of Europe. It's the end of the Biden administration. I mean, they're a lame duck, but they're hoping to, have Kamala Harris take over. Not with $12 a gallon oil of gas. Not with people unable to fill up their oil reservoirs in lead up to winter. It's the last thing that they need. And this will be the energy spike, price spike combined with longshoreman strike. It's over. Game, set, match. So the Biden administration isn't leaning towards a war, and Netanyahu knows that. This is all about Netanyahu. Neiman, remember, 2 weeks ago, how many Israelis were in the street protesting against Benjamin Netanyahu and the hostage deal? Hundreds of thousands. Has that problem gone away? No. Still there. Like I said, he did some trick plays. Everybody's talking about the trick play, except the trick plays didn't change anything strategically. The hostages are still held in Gaza. They ain't coming home until there's a ceasefire. That's a reality. Netanyahu cannot have a ceasefire and survive under the current conditions. So he's distracting. He's going into Lebanon and distracting. But he knows, again, trick plays don't change things. Israel couldn't invade Lebanon this entire time. Why? They don't have the military for it. How many times have you heard Israeli generals say, we can't do this, we don't want to do this? I mean, we said it 2 weeks ago, and everybody's like, yeah, no, Israel can't. But now, because some pagers blew up, everybody's going, no, Israel can go in the southern Lebanon. Israel can go in the south. No, they can't, and they're not. Look what they're doing. These are tiny little raids into going in just a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, just to say, oh, we went in. We did a special forces raid. We put a tank across the border. And what's Hezbollah doing? Hitting downtown Tel Aviv, hitting Haifa, hitting the Israeli troop concentrations. This is in what? Israel's going to go full in. I just want to remind people that I think it's called the Radwan Brigade. I might be wrong on this, but it's the big brigade that's responsible for defending Lebanon south of the Litani River. They have not been destroyed. They are still physically intact. And they have been training for 18 straight years for this fight. They know the ground better than anybody. They've thought through every tactical engagement point. There's only so many, when you have a Merkava tank, there's only so many ways you can enter southern Lebanon. Geography dictates that. And as you enter, it's generally speaking in a alluvial plain surrounded by hills moving into a valley. I think Hezbollah has plotted all this out. They have barriers in place, mine barriers. They can install new mine barriers. They've thought this out. So if Israel gets sucked in, it's a death trap. That's the reality of it. That's why Israel, I don't believe, is going to go into southern Lebanon in a massive invasion, because they can't. That doesn't mean that they won't, because again, this is all about preserving Benjamin Netanyahu's political legacy. Everything that's happening here is designed to keep him in a government whose existence is dependent upon war. And so he will keep stretching and stretching and stretching and stretching the envelope to keep this conflict. What he's looking for is the miracle. What he's looking for is to emerge from all of this as a victor. That's why he did all the trick plays. I mean, he blew up the pagers and he killed Hassan Nasrallah. That would have been a good time to say, I'm victorious. But now he's going for the big show. He's going to collapse Iran, collapse Hezbollah, and bring the 60,000 settlers home. And, nobody's talking about Gaza right now, because it's all focused on the big show in Lebanon, Hezbollah, the big threat. And we're going to, I think, again, I don't think the trick plays fundamentally harmed Hezbollah. I think when Israel decisively engages, it will not go well for Israel. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy for Hezbollah. Israel is a very capable military. I mean, they have an air force that, is not being effectively challenged. But they had that air force in 2006 and they lost. We'll find out what happens in the coming days. But, the United States, Biden can't afford to have a major war right now. But he also, this is where Netanyahu has him by the short and curlies, because Biden can't do what's necessary to get Israel to change its course of action. He can't stop the weapons supplies. He can't cut off aid. He can't do the standard things. I mean, there's a number of ways that this could end right now. But no politician seeking re-election has the courage to do what's necessary to change Israel's course of action, Netanyahu's course of action.
Yeah. When we look at Houthis together with Hezbollah, the way that they were attacking Israel so far, they didn't attack civilian part of Israel. They just attacked the military bases and so forth and so on. But do you find that the situation is that fragile that they're going to change their strategy, they're going to hit civilians, or they're not going to do that in their mind? That doesn't make sense.
Well, first of all, in wartime, civilians are going to pay the price no matter what. I mean, let's say hypothetically, I read one of your chats, somebody says it's already started. So apparently Iranian missiles are headed towards Israel. So we'll understand the targeting strategy behind that if what that gentleman says is accurate. But let's say Hezbollah or Iran decided to take out the Kirya, that is the Ministry of Defense enclave located in the center of Tel Aviv, a legitimate target no matter what. But I've been there many times. you know, all around it is civilian infrastructure. You get one deflected missile, you get a missile that's off by a little bit, you know, and now you've got apartment buildings coming down. It's not a war crime, by the way. That's just the tragic collateral damage that comes about during war. I think Iran is past the point of caring about collateral damage. I don't think Iran is going to deliberately target civilians, meaning saying, you know, let's hit the beachfront property in Tel Aviv and just flatten all the hotels. I don't think they're going to do that. That's not part of their nature. That's something that Israel does, but not what Iran's doing. But I think if Iran is serious about punishing Israel, and there's, I think April was their token attack. I think if they're attacking Israel now, it's designed to send a punishing blow to Israel, because that's the only way you reestablish a deterrence dominance. And dominance means that Israel hesitates to attack you, is to do something like that. It also means that Iran is ready to receive decisive strikes from Israel as well. I think that Iran, having struck, knows that Israel will strike back. And so I think at a minimum, you're looking at a massive blow by Iran towards Israel, and then a significant Israeli counterstrike. And then you're going to get the United States, Russia, and China to try and step in and prevent this thing from blowing all the way up. But if Iran has made the decision to send missiles into Israel, this isn't going to be a repeat of April. This is, I believe it's going to be a significant strike designed to inflict serious damage on Israel, and then Israel will have no choice but to strike back and seek to inflict serious harm on Iran. And at that point in time, somebody has to step in, or else we end up with a general war. And as I said, that's the end of energy security for the world. So we don't, you know, nobody wants that. And I saw somebody in there, you know, person saying, why is Scott smiling? I'll tell you what, you live the life I live, you do what I've done. And if you don't have you know, it's the same thing. You ever see me fight a fire when I was a fireman? Smile on my face. Why? Because I was scared to death. All right.
I do the same, Scott, by the way. I do the same.
Scared to death. You know, if you ever saw me, when the Scud missiles were coming down, it seemed everywhere I went during the Gulf War, Scud missiles followed me. We used to joke that Saddam knew that I was trying to kill his Scuds, so the Scud missiles were coming in. I was laughing my ass off, not because I thought it was funny, but because that's just the reaction to laugh. I every time I got in a fight, smile got on my face before I hit you, because it was just a ridiculous situation, so stupid. So when you see me smile like this, it's not because I think it's funny. It's because I think it's deadly serious. And that's just my my response. If we're ever in an airplane that's going down, look at my face. I'll be smiling ear to ear. Not because it's funny, just because sort of one of those ironic things in life. You know, this is it. Going down. Oh, boy. And there's going to be a smile on my face. If you don't like it, turn the damn TV off. I don't care. But don't try to read into things you don't understand.
Yeah, they do the same with me. If you remember, during the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, they were talking about, why you're laughing when you're talking about Donald Trump? It's a reaction, but my buddy's reaction. I don't control everything.
Because it's so stupid. It's so stupid. You're just sitting there going, is this real? I mean, we're sitting here talking about things that logic should dictate shouldn't happen. And as it's happening, you're just going, why are we even... this is so stupid. Why are you doing this? The outcome is not going to be what you think it's going to be. You know, and again, I just want to point out, I have friends in Beirut, dear friends. Marwa Osman, you may know her. She's a journalist. She's terrorized right now, what's happening. And she's traumatized. I have friends in northern Beirut. I communicate with them. I just sent them a text, and they texted back they're okay. But, you know, they're scared to death. This is a wonderful lady, her husband. They have a family there, kids. And, you know, their life is uncertain right now. You know, so the implication that I think this is funny, I don't think there's anything funny about this at all. These are dear friends of mine, people that I've worked with, people that I've met. Who lives are in danger. And, you know, it is what it is. But again, the smile, I mean, this is so stupid. What's happening? So stupid, so preventable, so utterly preventable. And yet it's happening.
And we had, Scott, a joint Russian-Syrian air raid on the on Idlib. And how, what was the reason behind that? And what is, what are the activities in that region that was of concern for Russia?
What, say the first part of that sentence?
In Idlib. They were attacking Idlib, Russia.
Well, I mean, what's in Idlib? Terrorists? Wahhabists? Al-Qaeda? You know, this is, again, people don't give Russia the credit that Russia deserves. You know, the Russians came in and saved Al-Assad. And I know there's a whole coterie of people out there who are like, Assad's a brutal murderer, a war criminal, this, that. Kiss my ever-loving butt. All right? You know who's a war criminal? ISIS. Al-Qaeda. CIA-backed so-called Free Syrian Army. These are outside perpetrators, actors coming in trying to change the regime of perhaps the most popular president Syria's ever had. You watch this guy walk down the streets of Damascus. Okay, he is loved, deeply loved. And that's not an Alawite community that he's walking down the streets. That's a Syrian community with, you know, Sunni, Shia, Alawites, Christians. They're all there. They love this man. They love this man because he has stood by them and he's dragged them through, you know, gotten them out of the gates of hell with the help of Russia. Russia intervened to prevent the black flag of Wahhabism from flying over Damascus. And they succeeded. The Russians then went around and did some interesting things. They brought in their military police. I always say that the Nobel Committee should give the Peace Prize to Russian military police for what they've done in Syria, because they've gone into a situation where, you know, Islamist extremists are not going to talk to the Syrian government. They're not going to talk to them. The Russians came in, separated the two, and then negotiated a deal where these extremists and their families could be evacuated to Idlib, thereby liberating much of the territory around Damascus in southern Syria from this this anti-regime entities. But now they're up in Idlib. Idlib was an area that it's the birthplace of Dara. In the south is where the original riots took place. But if you want the big fighting, it took place up in Idlib. I think it's Jizr al-Shagir is the name of the town that the original fighting took place. There's just that province has been taken over by Al-Qaeda, by al-Nusra. ISIS, I mean, every time al-Baghdadi was hanging out in Idlib, you know, when he got killed. So, you know, it's a place full of bad people. The Turks have come in. They've created, you know, a buffer zone that they've populated it with radical Uyghurs that they were able to coax out of China, bring in, train. There's a huge Uyghur population right now in Idlib. These are people who carry out horrific acts of terrorism and violence against anybody who opposes them. And, Russia's there to help the Syrian government regain sovereignty over the totality of its territory. And so you have these this al-Nusra front, you have these al-Qaeda elements, launching attacks against the Syrian government, against the Russians, and the Russians respond. And so, Russia drops bombs on these people because they want to weaken them. They want to demoralize them. They want to create the conditions where they will be compelled to either flee Syria, but nobody's going to take them, or die, which Russia's willing to help them do, or make an agreement with the Syrian government and try to reintegrate into society. And there are some elements there that can do that. There are some who will never be allowed to do that. And that becomes Turkey's problem. But I don't think Turkey wants to absorb radical Islamists. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, there's a certain element, a certain number of people in Idlib, they're going to have to die. That's just the reality of it. The situation is such that we've put the most evil people on the planet in a very tight space, and there's nowhere left for them to go. And so they're going to die. And Russia's going to help them die by dropping bombs on them. It's tragic. It's not a desirable outcome, but again, blame the United States. We're the ones that poured the money. We're the ones that empower, you know, empower Turkey, encourage Turkey to do this. Blame Turkey. Erdogan made a huge strategic error in turning his back on the friendship that he had with Bashar al-Assad. He went with the gamble that Assad was going to fall in 2012, 2013, and that he, Erdogan, would be able to assert Turkish sovereignty over the vilayet of Aleppo, where Idlib is adjacent to that, but, you know, take over this territory. Northern Syria would become Turkey again, part of the, you know, greater Turkey, just like he has visions of, you know, the vilayet of Mosul somehow returning to Turkey. It was a gamble. It failed miserably. And now, you know, he's left dealing with the consequences of this. And Russia is not going to let the pressure up. Russia is not going to allow the situation in Idlib, in Syria is not either, to become sort of the status quo. They want this thing resolved. Bashar al-Assad wants to have control over all of Syria. That includes not just Idlib, but also the areas in northwestern Syria where the United States and Turkey are occupying. This isn't going to happen unless continued pressure is brought to bear on those who are illegally occupying or illegally residing on Syrian, sovereign Syrian territory.
We have a huge community, Scott, here in Brazil, Syrian community. And they're having a hospital, one of the biggest hospitals of the country that they built for Brazil. And it's called a Syrian hospital in Sao Paulo. And I am connected with this community, especially with those ones who came after this conflict in Syria. They're talking about that mostly Christians. They're mostly Christians came here and they love Bashar al-Assad. They say what has happened to Syria is because of the United States and their support for these radical Islamists in that, in their country. And they're not Muslim, they're Christian, they're loving Bashar al-Assad. That was mind-blowing for me when they were talking, the way that they were talking about Bashar al-Assad and how he's trying to solve everything there.
Again, I have never been to Syria. And so I can't claim to have witnessed anything, you know, firsthand. I would love to go to Syria. Of course, that'll just put the FBI going, oh, well, he's a supporter of Bashar al-Assad. Well, who else do you want me to support, FBI in Syria? What's the alternative? What's the legitimate government of Syria? It's the Assad government. Is the Assad government perfect? No government's perfect. I think people rightly criticized the Assad government in their response to the drought of 2006-2007, that time period where his priorities were elsewhere. But where were his priorities? I mean, that's what a lot of people don't expect. This is a dentist who was never supposed to be the president of Syria. His elder brother was supposed to be the president of Syria, the heir apparent. And when Hafez al-Assad died, his older brother, I think, died in an automobile accident before the father died. And so now, Bashar al-Assad got pulled out and said, "You're the man." He inherited a Ba'athist regime that always viewed him as a non-entity, that had been positioning itself politically, domestically, to sort of move in and make Bashar al-Assad a figurehead, but they would run, you know, the Syria. The big problem out of Lebanon, the Syrian occupation of Lebanon, the general governor there was running. I mean, you know, there was a black market. There was, you know, stuff going back. Entire careers were made off of how to profit from the Syrian operation. And he came in and shut it down. I mean, think of that. Now think of the political consequences of shutting it down, the kind of infighting that would have to take place. And remember, this is a guy who was a dentist who wasn't in. He has to build relationships. He has to sit there and build up, you know, team Bashar al-Assad that's going up against these entrenched elites and dismantle the elites in a way that doesn't lead to a civil war. He has to win over the trust and confidence of the military. There's just so much that he has to do. And he wasn't able to do it all. And one of the things he didn't do was react timely and decisively in response to the droughts. Some people say that, you know, I mean, they're very critical, saying that he could have done more and he didn't. That's probably true. It's probably a very true statement. And as a result, vacuums were created within elements of Syrian society that were exploited. When you have a village lose its, you know, economic viability and the youth flee to the cities, but the cities aren't prepared to receive them. And now Saudi money comes in, and with Saudi money comes Saudi clerics who are Wahhabists, because Saudi Arabia is in the business of exporting Wahhabism. And these Saudi clerics start building the mosques that become the center of the social economic revival of these villages in this agricultural area. And so as people return, they fall under the sway of clerics who start challenging the Alawite leader of, you know, again, people who know anything about Syria understand the Alawites are sort of an offshoot of the Shia faith that even the strict Shia view is heretical. The Alawites aren't real Shia. And the Sunni, the Wahhabis, are definitely, they already have a problem with the Shia, and they really have a problem with the Alawites. And so, you know, this hatred builds up, and it's there, it's festering. And at a given time in 2011, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, the West pulled the trigger and weaponized these people. And, you know, we did it with Turkey. We took weapons out of Libya, flooded them into Turkey to get them into these people. Qatar is funding this. Saudi Arabia is funding it. And it looked like, you know, Bashar was going to fall. But that's when he stepped up to the plate. He didn't run. He could have run. He could have done what, you know, other tin pot dictators do, run. He and his wife rolled up their sleeves and they fought and they saved Syria. And Russia came in and helped them. But it wasn't just Russia. Iran came in and helped them. I think you know, Russia's intervention only happened because Qasem Soleimani flew to Moscow and said, "We need to come together on this, because otherwise, here's what's going to happen: Assad's going to fall, Syria's going to collapse, chaos is going to ensue, and we need Syria." And the Russian went okay, and they came in and they did it. But the idea that Bashar al-Assad is this wildly unpopular leader, I think in Syria today, he's probably got better than 80% support amongst the Syrian population. And that's something that the anti-Assad people just don't want to hear. But I think it's a true statement. And it's getting stronger every day as people realize that, left to his own devices, Bashar al-Assad is all about engendering stability, economic stability, social stability, political stability. He has plans for, you know, how can you move towards the democratization of a society when the outsiders are using democracy to attack you? It's impossible. But he has plans. He's not a brutal dictator. He wants what's best for Syria, and given the opportunity, I'm certain that he would come up with a plan of succession that leads Syria, you know, on a path of a revival. But it's hard to do when you've got this Wahhabist cancer in Idlib that's, you know, right there attacking Aleppo, attacking, you know, Latika and other places. No, it's got to be excised, and Russia's helping them excise.
And how, when you look at Zelensky's visit to the United States, and how do you evaluate the outcome of this visit? And do you think that Zelensky is getting the support that he asked for?
Zelensky is a failed leader of a failed state, and he's not getting the support that he asked for. He's getting the crumbs. He came up with a desperate plan, the Zelensky peace plan, which is little more than, it's called Ukraine Wins. And the victory of Ukraine is contingent upon the strategic defeat of Russia. And so he says, in order for Ukraine to win, to regain its territory, Russia must be defeated. In order to defeat Russia, Ukraine needs certain assistance from the West. It's pie in the sky stuff. Again, I think we alluded to earlier that, you know, that Europe is collapsing economically. You know, there's just no way Israel or Europe is in a position to provide the support that Zelensky claims to. It ultimately comes down to the United States. And again, right now, Look, some people, you know, have said it's comparing apples and oranges. You can't make comparison, but we just had a hurricane sweep through Appalachia and their entire community, cities that are gone. It doesn't resonate well with the American people that we just sent, you know, $7 point some odd billions of dollars to Ukraine and $8 some odd billions of dollars to Israel without question, just did it. And yet we're struggling to come up with the aid to these hurricane stricken places. It doesn't resonate well with America that we're giving away all this money to wars that have we don't get anything from these wars. It makes us weaker. Actually, it hurts us. If you don't understand how much Israel has hurt America in the last year, then you aren't looking at the global picture. We are becoming more and more isolated at a time when we're in this, again, I use this term a lot, but it's a true term, an existential struggle between the rules-based international order and the law-based multipolar order that Russia and China have been trying to put together since February of 2022, when Xi Jinping and Putin met in Beijing and issued a 5,000-word joint statement. This is a big deal. And in order to, give ourselves a fighting chance, we need to engage with the global South. We need to win them over. We need hesitancy on the part of the global South about the promise of BRICS. What Israel has done is destroyed American credibility around the world. And so when we start talking about people rallying around American democracy, people are saying, we sort of like this BRICS thing. And we've lost it. This is because of Israel. It's because of the United States, ultimately. But we could have at least had a fighting chance. We could have delayed the inevitable. We could have come up with a better plan. We have ignored BRICS so much. I mean, it's barely registering here in the West. Barely registering. But the world is about to change. If Russia pulls off what Russia is trying to pull off, and they've had nearly 200 what I call mini ministerials between the time they took the presidency of BRICS in January up until the lead up of this. This means that they're bringing together panels of political experts, economic experts, et cetera, to meet to staff the various issues that need to be resolved to create the structures necessary to turn the theory of BRICS into reality. Russia is about to turn BRICS into a grown-up organization with institutions. If Russia pulls this off, BRICS will emerge from Kazan with institutions that enable it to better coordinate the consensus-driven decision-making that is necessary in a multipolar environment. It looks like Russia is going to pull this off. And if that happens, the global South is going to be sucked into that vortex. And America is going to be sitting there going, whoa, what happened? It's us in Europe, and Europe's a sinking ship. It's us in Japan. They're a sinking ship, too. I mean, I'm starting to pay a little bit more attention to the Japanese economy, which apparently isn't as healthy as everybody makes it out to be. We'll be the ones that are isolated. And a lot of that isolation comes from the global reaction to what's going on with Israel and America's, unwillingness to stand up and do the right thing for Israel. There's this resentment. The United States isn't going to tolerate a war with a world war with Russia, and that's what Zelensky's asking for. We can't afford it right now, and the other thing is it could go nuclear that quick. I mean, I'm not sometimes I think Medvedev is just saying things, but he is the deputy of the National Security Council. Former president, former prime minister, he just told the Baltic states, Article 5 doesn't protect you when a Russian nuclear bomb wipes you off the face of the earth. It may kick in, but you won't know it because you'll be dead. You'll be a wet spot on the planet, he said. Now, why is he saying this? Well, because he knows, he knows what Russian nuclear doctrine is. He knows what will happen if NATO goes to war, if the Baltics were able to, ever dared act out what they claim. We will be the initial strike against Russia and any NATO. No, you'll disappear instantly. It doesn't take much to remove Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia from the face of the earth. This is the stupidity. And yet in the West, Russia's bluffing. Well, you can say that until Russia isn't bluffing. Then it's too late. Is it really worth the risk? is it really worth the call, you know, the call bluff on this one? I mean, I could understand, you know, playing Russian roulette. I mean, I really couldn't ever understand it. But if someone said, you know, it's like a, you know, out of the Deer Hunter, you know, well, if I do this, I can escape from prison. Or if I pull the trigger on this, I can win $1 million and change my life. Okay, is your life that bad that you have to do that? Yes, I have no choice. Okay, right. But right now, the game of Russian roulette doesn't give us anything good. All it's going to do is kill us. And we're playing Russian roulette, frankly speaking, with a 6-chambered revolver and there's 6 bullets in it, which means it's not Russian roulette, it's suicide. And that's what we're engaged in right now, an act of suicide. And we're not recognizing it as such. We aren't going, you cannot strategically defeat a nuclear power. The Soviet Union defeated itself. We didn't defeat it. The Soviet Union collapsed of its own volition. We actually weren't seeking it. If you go back and take a look at George H.W. Bush's speech in Kiev, in the lead up to the collapse, it's called the Chicken Kiev speech. And basically he went in there and he threw cold water on Ukraine's aspirations for independence, because we were trying to manage. We didn't want the collapse of the Soviet Union. We were uncertain about what would happen. We had this nascent developing relationship with Gorbachev that we were trying to flesh out. There was a lot of hesitancy, uncertainty, but we weren't actively saying go, 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 because we didn't know what was going to come from it. It collapsed because Boris Yeltsin pulled Russia from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And that changed the entire tax structure. That changed how monies were distributed. That changed the balance of power, because Russia was always the largest republic of the Soviet republics. And when Russia declared independence from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, it basically made the Communist Party of the Soviet Union a paper tiger, an empty shell with no power. And it gutted Gorbachev's ability to continue to rule as the president of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union committed suicide. That's what happened. It wasn't a defeat. So there's people like that. Oh, no, well, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons and it went away. We could do the same thing to Russia. Different, totally different thing. Russia ain't in danger of collapsing in on itself. In fact, Putin's re-election in March proves that. Russia's stronger economically than it's ever, stronger than we are. So not in terms of the size, but the health. Russia doesn't have a $36 trillion debt, I'll tell you that much. So Russia's got growth. Germany just announced there will be no growth next year. No growth, which tends to mean actually be depression. Not a recession, depression in Germany. That's the end of the German economy. That's the end of the European Union. If German economy collapses, there is no viability of the European Union. This is the reality out there. And yet NATO, the European Union, and the United States continue to embrace a strategic direction that says we want to strategically defeat Russia. You can't. And if you did, you'd die. Because if you ever strategically defeated Russia as a nuclear power, they would use their nuclear weapons to prevent their defeat. That's just the way it rocks, baby. And yet that's what Ukraine wants. That's the direction they want to go. It's a suicide pill. It's an unrealistic policy. It's an irresponsible policy. And I think there's a growing recognition in the United States of that. But so much political capital has been put into propping up Ukraine that we are, and this is what I believe the strategic decision has been made. They know Ukraine's lost the war. And they know that there's not much we can do to, you know, resolve that situation, salvage it. In fact, there's nothing we can do. So Ukraine's going to sink, and we're going to be seen throwing life preservers into the water. That's it. We're going to say we did everything we could to help. And we were there to save them in the end. But that ship's going down with the crew, with the captain. It's gone. And that's the reality. Ukraine is gone. It's not going to survive this winter. Whatever comes out rolling into the spring is going to have to unconditionally surrender to Russia. That's the reality. If they survive now, I mean, the Russians are in the process of destroying the Ukrainian military on the battlefield.
And when part of this equation in Ukraine is the situation of Zelensky administration. And since this conflict started, we have Zelensky getting out, the foreign minister getting out, and right now the head of intelligence of Ukrainian are talking about he's going to resign. And And at the same time, you're having that some disagreements, many disagreements, not some disagreement, between Zelensky and Syrsky. Do you think that it's going to collapse in Ukraine and the United States? How the United States can manage the situation in Ukraine? Is that possible? Or if gets out of the hand, it's out of the hand. They're not capable of doing anything.
Well, the concept of managing something implies that you're in control. And there's the ultimate statement of hubris. You know, I can manage the collapse of Ukraine. That implies that I'm in control of what happens in Ukraine. We control nothing in Ukraine. Nothing. I mean, you know, we may think we control Zelensky, but we really don't. I mean, we could control him the way we controlled, President Diem in Vietnam, have him killed. But then what happens after that? Who replaces him? What power structures move in? We're not in control of that. We can't dictate that outcome. We don't know. Zelensky right now is the president of what? Nothing. He's not the president. And that's a growing concern, not just from around the world. What the decisions he's making right now, what's the constitutional basis of this? He's operating outside the constitution of Ukraine. There were no presidential elections. His term in office has gone away. And you see parliamentarians starting to question this. You know, why do we have this man here? Why is he continuing to be president when he's not? We need to have an election. We need to come up with some sort of process that is constitutional in nature for this, you know, this leadership. And you see the lack of trust and confidence in the Zelensky regime is gone. Ministers are fleeing. One of the reasons is because they're so corrupt that you can't hide the corruption anymore. And so they've literally taken the money we've given them. They've already put it in bank accounts around that we helped put them in because we understand the game. Remember, we were giving the Afghan warlords literally suitcases full of money up until the very end. I mean, one of the most embarrassing stories is how the CIA delivered a whole bunch of money to a guy who ended up basically putting on a helicopter so fast that they were falling off and the dollars were being spread all over the place. But the CIA was delivering money to the warlords up until the very end. And we will continue delivering money to these corrupt people that we've empowered in Ukraine up until the very end. But they're not taking the money, just like the Afghans didn't take the money to die for this cause. When you're corrupt and you take money like that, that means you want to live. No corrupt official is going to be on the front line holding the weapon. I mean, you may not like Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, but I'll tell you what, when, you know, the people were in the streets after the, you know, so-called contested election and, you know, things were getting ugly, that guy got off a helicopter holding an automatic weapon saying, bring it on, you know, dying in the streets. Saddam Hussein didn't run. Saddam Hussein was willing to fight. In fact, he had to be physically put into a vehicle when Baghdad fell and taken out of Baghdad because he was getting ready to make a last stand in Adamiya. And his lieutenant said, no. We're going to get you up to Oujda and hide you around and see if we can, you know, ride this thing out. Didn't work out for him, but, you know, he didn't flee with all the gold and, you know, he was supposed to be the most corrupt individual in the world with all the gold and all the money and all this stuff. He didn't flee with that. He didn't run. Look at Ukraine. They're all running away. Look at Afghanistan. They all fled. How many Afghan leaders sat there and fought to the death when the Taliban came in? Did Karzai and company defend the palace to the death? Dig in, bring it on, let's do it. No, they ran with their money because they're corrupt. And that's eventually what's going to happen here is that the Zelensky cronies are going to run with their money. They've already put billions and billions around the world, hidden in real estate, hidden in banks, hidden in other investments. It's sickening that we support this kind of stuff, but that's the way it's going to be. But Zelensky is, you know, he can't, there's nothing viable. Again, let's see what happens this winter. Because right now he continues to exist. I mean, he just got more money. So if you're corrupt and you're saying, well, as long as Zelensky's in power, we get our money. Well, they just got their money. But I let's see how many of these people ride out the winter. Let's see how full the Ukrainian parliament is come spring of 2025. Let's see how many Ukrainian ministers are still in play. And I think you're going to start to see Ukrainian generals start to flee too. When the going gets tough, the corrupt get going, and they're going to be fleeing with their money. In the end, it's going to be a bunch of colonels on the front line with their soldiers looking around going, there's nothing left worth fighting for. And that's going to be it.
You talk about Olaf Scholz. Do you think that Germany is awakening and finally it can help the European Union?
I think Scholz is, again, this is a decision that could have been made a long time ago. But he didn't do it because he gambled. Scholz, like the rest of Europe, gambled on sanctions actually causing the collapse of Russia, weakening Russia, Ukraine prevailing. Didn't happen. The sanctions backfired. He's now looking at election results and realizing that his party is gone. His coalition is finished. The lefts have the Greens have no more credibility. The lefts are gone. Socialist Democratic Party is finished. It's an act of desperation to maintain his viability as a leader. He has to address these issues. And so he will, we now see for the first time, he's talking about an investigation into Nord Stream, because how do you explain to the German people why you have zero growth? You are the strongest economy in Europe and you have zero growth and you're going to have a depression. Zero growth is optimistic. The reality is a collapse of the German economy. That's what's happening. You're the one in charge. How do you explain that? So I think he's going to call the Russians and say, we have to work something out, and the Russians are, what he thinks Russia is going to give up on Ukraine. I think Scholz understands Ukraine's a lost cause. And so I think he's going to try and make an effort to trade the resumption of energy engagement with Germany and by extension, at least Western Europe. I mean, the Eastern European states are lost, Poland, the Baltics, all this, but they can't survive in isolation. They're nothing without being propped up by the rest of Europe. But Scholz is getting ready to jump ship. He has no choice. And so I think he's looking for a compromise solution where he can trade the resumption of energy for some sort of settlement in Ukraine. And you hear a lot of talk about this right now, that Ukraine is being pressured to permanently give up territory, meaning that there would be a treaty-based arrangement with Russia that permanently gives Russia the territories that are now, that Russia claims are it. But in exchange, Ukraine gets to join NATO. Russia will never go with that. I think it's beyond that. These are things that could have been talked about earlier, but I think you're looking at the total collapse. Russia didn't invest all this time and effort into bringing down Ukraine just to throw it all away at the end because Olaf Scholz is in a political bind. There's a deal there to be made. The question is how desperate Europe is at the time that that deal is still on the table. Because the longer you wait and the more certain decisive Russian victory becomes, the less likely it is that Russia is going to want to be seen as giving away that which it doesn't need to give. And asking for Ukrainian membership for NATO, Russia will never go with it. It'll never happen. The best you're going to get is neutrality and hope that Russia is kind enough to leave enough of Ukraine, physically intact that you can, Ukraine has economic viability. Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, Kharkov, Sumy, Mykolaiv, these are territories that Russia could easily justify absorbing, given what Sumy should never be Ukraine again, because it was used as a launching pad into Kursk. Kharkov should never be Ukraine again, because it was used as a launching pad into Belgorod. Odessa is used to attack Crimea. Russia has every right to say, you've lost these territories in perpetuity. They will become part of Russia, and insist on that being part of a final peace deal. Maybe Germany can come in and negotiate something that says, we'll lift the sanctions, we'll get you back into the energy business in Europe, but you have to be satisfied with the territory. And look at Putin. He said, we're not in it for territorial acquisition. So there's a compromise out there waiting to be had. Let's see if Germany has the ability to pull this off. But right now, Germany is desperate. But Europe is not far behind. I mean, what's happening to Germany is going to happen to the rest of Europe.
Scott, as we talk, Iran is attacking Israel. 300 missiles are heading toward Israel, and we see, I see the footage here, they're just hitting the targets, it seems, in some places, but the sky over Israel is just firing, and what's going on? And
live by the sword, die by the sword. I mean, normally I'd my heart would be broken, but not now. I'm sorry, Israel. You get what you deserve. I hope innocent civilians aren't killed, but I hope every Iranian missile hits the target it's aimed at, because Israel is a illegal genocidal state whose continued survival is a cancer to the health of the Middle East. Netanyahu is an evil man, a truly evil man, a genocidal maniac who only wants to bring death and destruction. And, you know, I would just hope that Iran follows through on what it started. Because if you think that this is going to change Israel's behavior, if you think that Netanyahu is going to change, it's not. Now, if this triggers a response from inside Israel to collapse a Netanyahu government and replace it with somebody with a coalition that's willing to talk about peace and Palestine, fine. But there's no such coalition. Even those people who put pressure on Netanyahu to free the hostages are not about pro-Palestine. They're not in support of Palestine. There's no politically viable movement in Israel anymore that talks about the need for a Palestinian state. Israel has been poisoned by Netanyahu for the past decades, and that poison has seeped through every aspect of Israeli society.
Do you think that the Biden administration, is it going to point that the Biden administration says enough to Netanyahu?
Say again?
Says enough is enough. We're not going to go with the plan of going and fighting each and every country in the region.
Well, I mean, the United States has said that it will defend Israel, but it won't participate in attacks. And there's no case that could be made by the United States that what Iran is doing is unprovoked. Everybody knows the provocations that were done. And again, the Biden administration is going to try and nip this thing in the bud because they don't want a regional war that leads to threatening of global energy security and what that does to the oil markets and, you know, price here during an election season. We're just a few weeks away from a national election. The Biden administration is trying to make the case that they've brought about economic health to America, you know, and watch that all dissolve. And there's no way you can make the case that the Biden administration isn't to blame for what's happening with Israel. They've had a year to put pressure on Israel, and they didn't. And now the refusal to stand up to Israel has led to a conflict that could very well impact the economic health of the United States.
Yeah. And just to finalize this talk, Scott, you've mentioned how important is this communication between Europeans and Russia. We know how the security treaty between Russia and Europe is crucial, is important for the future of Ukraine, for the future of Russia, the relationship between Europe and Russia. And how do you see right now, in terms of what we're witnessing in the United Kingdom and the sort of animosity that they're having toward Russia, is that possible to have a new treaty, a security treaty between Russia and the European Union?
Well, I think you have a failed assumption here. Russia has no interest in being a partner with Europe anymore. Europe can't be trusted. Europe brings nothing to the table in its current configuration. Ukraine has no future. That's the other thing you have to understand. Don't stop talking about the future of Ukraine. Ukraine has no future. It lost a war. That's the reality. Ukraine has lost this war. Ukraine doesn't get to function as a meaningful actor. That's Zelensky's fantasy, that the world revolves around Ukraine, that Ukraine will have a seat at the table, that because Ukraine was the shield that protected Europe from Russia, Ukraine now has... Ukraine is defeated, a defeated nation that'll, you know, sink back into the pathetic, world that it deserves to occupy as long as you have Ukrainian nationals. I've been reading up. I mean, you go back and you take a look at Yatsenko and the first prime minister and the things he talked about. He called Russians subhuman, and he empowered people that talked about how the Donbass was overpopulated with a certain element that had to be, basically eliminated. He said that, eliminated. About a third. He's talking about Russian speakers. And so you have a Ukrainian government that after 2014 was actively engaged conceptually and in action with the genocide of Russian speakers. And you want me to have sympathy for these people? You want me to sit there and say, no, show them mercy. You can't. And this is why Russia, when Russia speaks about denazification, we in the West tend to point at that and say, well, come on, Nazism really died in 1945 with Adolf Hitler. But it didn't. The Banderist ideology, which has been promoted and promulgated by the United States. Again, I point to Ellenville, New York, right down the road, where they have four statues, including the Stepan Bandera and Roman Shushkovich, mass murderers, disgusting human beings, pigs. They're called heroes. And there's a children's camp. Every year they send, Ukrainian-American children there to be polluted with the minds of Banderism. They literally walk around with the Banderist flags and they sing songs to our father, Stepan Bandera. And that's what Ukraine is right now. It's a disgusting, seething mass of, Nazi derivative hate. And you want that to live? No, Ukraine has to die in its current manifestation. Whatever comes from Ukraine, we'll find out. But to sit here and claim that somehow we have to be concerned about the future of Ukraine, when Ukraine has been nothing but a cancer to Europe and Russia ever since the end of the Second World War. Study. One of these days, people will do the study. I don't know if I'll live long enough and have access to the documents. But study what happened when the Russians crushed the Ukrainian nationalist movement in the early to mid 1950s. A quarter of a million people fled, went into diaspora to Ellenville and other places. But the others were taken and put in the gulag. And then Khrushchev came and released them. And study how they came back and how they re-insinuated themselves into Ukrainian society with the help of the CIA. The CIA ran an active operation from 1948 up until 1990, the job of which was to insinuate the Banderists, the Nazis, into Ukrainian political structures, economic structures, social structures. And that's why you saw the ease. Remember, 2014 wasn't the first time that Ukrainian nationalism lifted its ugly head politically. I think the 2004-2005 election put in place a prime minister who turned around. One of his first actions was to make Stepan Bandera the national hero of Ukraine. So this is a disease that's infected Ukraine for some time now. And it has to be pulled out root and stem. It can't be allowed to exist. So let's stop talking about Ukraine and its current manifestation that we have to somehow preserve it. No, it has to be done away with. And that's happening right now as we speak. So we can't be talking about Russia wanting that to happen. Anybody who says, well, we want to preserve Ukraine, Russia does not want to preserve Ukraine. That's what denazification is. And they're not going to allow Ukraine to be part of NATO. That's what demilitarization is. These are the two fundamental pillars of Russian policy towards Ukraine. And as long as the West insists on a Zelensky-style government or derivative government being in power in Ukraine, that hasn't denazified anything. And as long as they insist that NATO have some sort of role in Ukraine, that hasn't demilitarized. So these are artificial hopes. So we need to remove that. And Russia has been betrayed by Europe one too many times. So Russia's in no hurry to repair relations with the West. In fact, from their perspective, letting the West simmer in the juices of the stew it's created for himself might not be a bad thing. Because what, do you really want to engage with Emmanuel Macron? Russia doesn't want to engage with him. Why? He's the guy talking about sending French troops off there. He's a man who thinks that France is somehow relevant. Why not let France drop down a little bit? Germany sat there and literally almost put the swastika armbands back on as German tanks were in Kursk. That really, you want to deal with that, Jerry? Let the Germans simmer. And the same thing with the United Kingdom. If you think that Starmer's at the head of a healthy entity right now, Keir Starmer, that he's somehow, there's a reason why Great Britain's had five prime ministers in 5 years, because they suck. Their whole situation sucks. he's not going to be able to put together a budget that can do anything, let alone live up to the naive glorification of somehow the resurgence of the British military leading Europe on a path to victory against Russia. Let the UK simmer a little bit. And as for America, a little bit different here, because Russia does need at some point in time to engage with us on strategic arms control. But we have to have America purged of the Russophobes, these Putin whisperers that have been in the ear of administration after administration after administration, have to be discredited. They have to be nullified politically. You have to purge academia. Georgetown University needs to fire 80% of its adjunct professors, all these former CIA and State Department people to go in there and breathe hatred to the next generation of American diplomats. Stanford needs to get rid of Michael McFaul and anything that touched Michael McFaul. Harvard needs to purge itself. So does Yale. Start training the next generation of, you know, Russian experts to be genuine Russian experts, never to turn their back on America and what America needs, what America wants, but to be realistic about how to deal with Russia, not looking for war, but looking for peace. Russia's in a position right now where they're winning. BRICS is a huge victory. They've resolved the issue of how to economically survive without the West, with their relations with India, with China, their growing relationship with Africa. Russia doesn't have to do anything right now. And I don't think Russia's in any rush to do anything. Russia will always leave the door open to discussions. They've never shut the door. But these discussions aren't going to be what the West thinks they're going to be. They're going to be a completely different agenda. And that agenda is going to have to be politically acceptable. And that's not going to happen with the current generation or the current iteration of political elites in Europe. Olaf Scholz will never be able to cut a deal with Vladimir Putin because Vladimir Putin will never trust Olaf Scholz. Putin may trust the person that comes after Olaf Scholz. I don't think Vladimir Putin's ever going to trust Emmanuel Macron. He'll trust the person that comes after Emmanuel Macron. And the same thing with you know, Keir Starmer. Won't even begin to talk to them. Maybe somebody after, people who are genuinely sincere about working out a deal, as opposed to, how sincere can you be when you're desperate to save yourself from a ship, sinking ship? You'll say anything to get off that sinking ship. I think the Russians are going to let that ship sink and wait for the next crew to come in. So that's just my take. Again, I can't speak for Russia. The Russians have to look at, you know, their own situation. But I think BRICS is a huge empowering vehicle for Russia. And they're in no hurry to help Europe get out of the mess that they've made. Russia's paid too heavy of a price. I just want to remind people that Russia's lost, even though the Russians haven't admitted this, my calculations are they've lost over 100,000 dead. You don't lose 100,000 dead and just say nothing. And remember, Russia doesn't blame Ukraine on this. This is a war against NATO and the collective West. Russia blames the West for these dead, as they should. So I don't think Russia's in any hurry to make good with the West. Russia doesn't need to. It's the West that needs to make good with Russia. So Russia will pick the time and place when it's time to go in that direction. But the terms I think Russia will set, they'll be fair, but they'll be harsh. They'll be fair, but they'll be harsh.
Scott, one of our audience asking, just to wrap up this session, he's asking a question that it says, is these attempts to assassinate Donald Trump, they're talking about that are related to Iran, and Iran is trying to do this. And is there any sort of reality behind these allegations, or they're trying to do a false flag, some sort of allegations and type of idea to buy support for Israel?
Again, let's go back to what we talked about earlier. The new president of Iran exists because the supreme leader wanted him to exist. The supreme leader would have accepted any one of the candidates because they were all vetted with the supreme leader in mind, meaning they were all deemed to be politically viable. Each one of them, had they won a majority, would have had a mandate amongst a certain segment of the population where the supreme leader could say, okay, that's the direction the people want to go. The people of Iran elected a moderate reformer who was looking for better relations with the West. And the supreme leader accepted this by agreeing with those results and making him blessing him to be the president of of Iran. And this guy is now, you know, came over and made a good faith effort to improve relations. The reason why I bring all that up is, you really think they'd go through all that and then say, but really, we're out to kill Donald Trump? No. No. I think what you have is the U.S. intelligence community just isn't what it used to be. It isn't what it used to be. I think that there's a lot of trolling going on from inside Iran. There are hard-line elements in Iran that you know, want revenge for Qasem Soleimani's death and have pledged revenge and you know, have put out slick videos showing, you know, Iranian, you know, drone, you know, wheel, you know, remote control vehicles flying around and taking pictures of Trump playing golf and lining up the shot. And there's some chatter amongst people in Iran, you know, about how desirable it would be to kill Trump, never forget, But it ignores the fact that the leadership that makes all these decisions, that's not the direction they're going. And the people that are making the videos don't get to make policy, and they don't control the forces necessary to bring down Donald Trump. So I think U.S. intelligence community basically allowed itself to be politicized yet again. They took a low-level assessment that was made about, you know, could Iran be looking to assassinate Donald Trump? And after the Ukrainian brokered assassination attempt in Tampa said, we have to detract from Ukraine, distract from that, and promote the Iranian threat, which they did. And when you have Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, briefing Donald Trump on this, again, it just shows the politicization of this. I don't think there's a real threat coming out of Iran. I think this is a false flag designed to distract Donald Trump and get him to do exactly what he did. Exactly what he did, which is to talk tough about Iran and the need to bomb Iran, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Have a great day.
Okay.